man is your land. This man is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This man was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend Lease, episode 20. We have just a couple more weeks to go before we return to the air. This week, we are going to be talking about climate change and the end of the liberal world as we know it. We're recording this on January 19th, 2020. This is going to be a pretty grim episode, so buckle up for that, I guess. Specifically, we'll be talking a lot about Australia, but then also sort of contextualizing things more broadly. Joining me this week on the show, are in Idaho, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line here in Massachusetts with me is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Bill and Rachel.
Okay, so let's start by talking about the actual situation in Australia, and then I will elaborate on what I mean by the end of the liberal world as we know it. Rachel, I guess first I will say, two episodes that I want to recommend that people listen to if they haven't listened to that's not our show is the Bunta Vista podcast. I think the full name Bunta Vista Socialist Club, but it goes by Bunta Vista on iTunes if you're searching for it. Episodes 130 and 131 are both firsthand frontline accounts of the fire situation that's going on there. And we're going to be talking about a number of things that they brought up on those episodes. And I actually talked to Andrew by direct message on Twitter to ask some clarifying questions about certain elements of things that he mentioned. But Rachel, why don't you first start us off by recapping the actual scope and scale of the fire situation so we can know what we're talking about here.
Right. So I kind of found a by the numbers article on BBC.com. This was dated January 13th, so it's most likely gotten even worse. Currently, the hardest hit state is New South Wales with 130 fires. Again, that's probably increased. 31 more in Victoria. 28 people so far have been killed, including four firefighters. An estimated 10 million hectares, which is 100,000 square kilometers or 15.6 million acres, have burned. They showed a visual comparison. That's basically the entire area of England and Wales. To kind of put that in perspective. Like I said, the worst hit state is New South Wales. It's affected more than 5 million hectares, destroying more than 2,000 houses and forcing thousands to evacuate. The Australian capital, Canberra, has seen some of the worst smoke pollution, with air quality rated the third worst of all major global cities on the 3rd of January. On that Bunta Vista episode 130, they mentioned a story where a woman flew into Canberra Airport and suffered a medical emergency basically on the tarmac just minutes after landing in Canberra, and she died, just to kind of put into kind of stark relief just how bad the situation is.
Also, as another comparative point, since you were mentioning about, you know, England and Wales and so forth, a lot of the comparisons that have been in the news have been to various European countries. If it helps people to understand in the context of U.S. states, because Australia and the U.S., continental U.S., are similar sizes in some ways, it would be somewhere in area between the size of the state of Indiana and the state of Kentucky have burned so far. Like, that's a crazy amount that we're talking about.
Right. I think the U.S. picture that the BBC had, it was covering like Philadelphia and New York, basically. So just a really, really large landmass has been burned. This is in the wake of Australia having its all-time hottest summer ever. They broke their all-time temperature record twice in December. An average maximum of 40.9 degrees Celsius or 106 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded on the 17th of December, broken just a day later by a max of 41.9 degrees Celsius, which is about 107 degrees Fahrenheit, both beating 2013's record of 40.3 degrees Celsius or about 105 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's that's across all of Australia, averaging their maximum temps. Imagine our in the U.S. summer, our entire country being 100+ degrees in the summer. You don't really, it's kind of hard to fathom that. Like, Seattle, Washington very rarely beats like 90 degrees or 95 degrees. So imagine everywhere across the U.S. being over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. It's insane. By the end of December, every state had measured temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius, including Tasmania, which is usually much cooler than the mainland, being an island. So right now, the air quality, as we said before, is really bad. It's blowing all the way to New Zealand. On Twitter, you can see pictures of the sky in New Zealand. It's just filled with smoke and looks really terrible. The fires are so bad, they're generating their own weather. They're generating thunder and wind storms as the smoke cools in the upper atmosphere. It forms a cloud, which causes those thunderstorms. So it's just kind of a self-perpetuating terrible weather system happening right now that is just feeding the fires. In December, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison got really browbeat in the news because he just basically fled the country and went to Hawaii for Christmas vacation. He got a lot of backlash for that. He hasn't really responded well to these fires, just kind of ignored it for as long as possible until it finally just got so bad he had to respond.
Yeah, his defense was, well, I wouldn't be out there holding a hose personally, which is in direct contrast with his predecessor, Tony Abbott, who is a volunteer firefighter. Not to give Tony Abbott credit, because Tony Abbott's also a moron, but...
Yeah, if you've heard anything about Australia's prime ministers for the past few years, it's been pretty dire. New South Wales was begging for federal help. A lot of the fire response has been coordinated by the states without very much federal help. So New South Wales was just begging for help. There finally, after the federal response, the Australian Defence Force reservists were going to be deployed to New South Wales. New South Wales's Rural Fire Service Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons only learned of that deployment on the news. There was no communication, no coordination. Fitzsimmons said Morrison had not told him personally of the plan to deploy these reservists, and Commonwealth and ADF liaison officers embedded in the state control center were also unaware. So it's just been bungled left and right. The federal government has done very, very little to help these states in their states of emergency. So that leads me to January 12th. There's a New York Times article stating that Scott Morrison announced on Sunday that he would call for a high-level government inquiry into the response to the country's devastating bushfires. It's kind of seen as just kind of a way to kick the can down the road. These inquiries kind of take 12 to 18 months, so people can be like, oh no, what happened? But don't really offer any lasting commitment to changing how policies are enacted. It's just kind of a way for the government to delay meaningful action on a divisive subject. There's a quote from John Blaxland, a professor at the Australian National University in Canberra. Says, "It's a fob off. They always are. They give you a good 18 months of political grace for the issue to die down politically and then shelve it when it comes out." So PM Morrison hasn't really committed to making any changes to policies on renewable energy, fossil fuels, and coal. Australia is one of the largest exporters of coal in the world. I know Australia's kind of been touting how low their emissions are, but it doesn't really take into account the emissions of the coal that they export to other countries. So Australia can kind of pat themselves on the back saying like, oh, we're a low emission country. We don't have that many people population wise. So we don't really need to do anything to act on climate change. However, they're exporting all this coal to other countries, and they're emitting the carbon into the atmosphere. So they're definitely not not innocent in that regard at all. And this is kind of a multi-partisan issue. The opposition shadow minister tweeted recently that he was touting Australia's coal exports to developing nations as a way for them to get renewables off the ground. He was kind of spouting the quote unquote clean coal line. That is,
yeah, it was like bonk. Instead of natural gas being a bridge fuel, his pitch was that developing nations could use Australian coal as a bridge fuel because Australian coal, at least according to him, is somewhat lower emissions than some other countries' coal is, because there are different types of coal. But that was the extent to which it was clean coal, which was not very.
Right. And then were people pointing out that like you need certain, like, I don't know, factories or processing plants for certain types of coal, so you can't just like mix and match the coal like he proposed.
Right, cool. Exactly. Yeah. So he was just spouting pure bunk science and trying to make Australia look good, but they are definitely a huge contributor to climate, man-made climate change. In the midst of all this, there are many, many volunteer firefighters going out and fighting these fires. ABC on the 14th released an article saying many volunteers are not eligible for compensation for their work fighting these fires, putting themselves in danger, leaving their regular jobs to fight these fires. Many volunteers, including people that are on pension or unemployed, are not eligible for compensation. Compensation only kicks in after 10 days of volunteer work and only applies to the 11th day forward. So the first 10 days, I think somebody who was kind of a spokesperson for this said it's kind of like a trial period, and so they wouldn't get paid for that. And it's this compensation only applies to volunteers who are self-employed and work for small or medium-sized businesses. So if you work for a big business or are unemployed, you're just basically out of luck. The federal natural disaster and emergency management minister, David Littleproud, urged large businesses to support employees who took time off work to fight fires. He said, "Big business benefits more than most of us from the hard work of our volunteer firefighters, and I urge them to support their staff who are part of volunteer services." So basically, I guess big business is just supposed to compensate these firefighters out of the goodness of their hearts, and the government wouldn't honor the commitment of these firefighters monetarily. Also, the firefighters who do qualify for compensation only receive $300 per day, up to $6,000 total. So it seems to be not that great of a compensation package anyway, even if you are eligible for it, which many, many volunteers are not. So all the way around, I would say Australia's response to this disaster has been lacking and just not good enough for a federal government of a large developed nation. They're just not, I guess, living up to their part in the social contract.
Yeah, certainly some flashbacks in my mind to, you know, the Bush administration and Michael Brown at FEMA responding to Hurricane Katrina.
Heck of a job, Brown.
Not responding, yeah. So far we've been talking in relatively abstract terms. It's sort of hard to capture the experience of being on the ground with this sort of just dark haze everywhere and not able to breathe without your, you know, throat hurting and that kind of thing. Or, you know, the side of the road being lined with, you know, dead kangaroos and things like that, just charred corpses. So again, I refer people to episode 130 of Bunta Vista if you want to hear more about that, want to hear about the discussions of the you know, evacuations, getting stuck on the highway, not being able to get out, having a helicopter land on the lawn to refuel, you know, right in front of you. talking about the tourists getting evacuated by the military from the beach. There was in certain touristy towns, there were, thousands of people having to get Dunkirk style evacuations by the Australian Defense Forces.
As with the fires blood closed red in skies. Around
them. Yeah.
And also another thing they talked about on these episodes was the difficulty in buying the right grade masks that would protect you from the particulates in the air. So I guess they were saying that there was really no place to buy them in some provinces. You had to wait at the place where they got the shipments, the store or whatever, and then they would just give those away to the people that were already waiting there. But otherwise, it was extremely difficult to get the masks.
Also, Nate, Rachel talked about somebody dying on the spot as she got off the plane in Canberra. Can you talk about another incident, high-profile incident related to the fires of someone collapsing?
Yeah, I saw this on Twitter the other day, but there was a competitor at the Australian Open tennis tournament who was basically collapsed on the ground, coughing, had a coughing fit, and withdrew from the match. Dalia Jakupovic from the Women's Tennis Association withdrew from a qualifying match. Maria Sharapova's match, a very famous tennis player, was abandoned after 2 hours of play in smoky air. Novak Djokovic said before the start of the tournament that delaying the competition might be necessary. So I'm not sure where they're at with that right now. I haven't been following that tennis tournament, but it's pretty clear that it's extremely there's a lot of evidence that it makes it very difficult to do athletic exercise or to perform well when there's all these particles in the air. It can reduce lung function, blood flow. And then, as we saw, there was the Rachel mentioned the woman who got off the plane and almost immediately had respiratory issues and eventually died. So, yeah, this is pretty clear, especially when you have people just like collapsed on the ground, uncontrollably coughing. That pretty much puts into sort of stark relief what kind of situation we're dealing with here. It's like, no, you can't really just have a tennis tournament, pretend everything's fine, because there's a lot of smoke in the air and it's making it extremely difficult to breathe.
All right, so we've taken about 15 minutes or so to recap the actual events so far of the fires, and Rachel has obviously touched somewhat on the very poor response by the civilian government. Now I want to step back more broadly and just analyze this response and what I see as the significance of this. So essentially, we have the civilian government completely checked out on this. I think their emergency management guy even went on a trip to Europe while this was happening, as opposed to Hawaii from the prime minister. All around, a bad response. Rachel mentioned about, people finding out stuff from the news when they're leadership that needs to know what's going on, and they're just not hearing from the federal government. We've also talked about the fact that the Australian Defense Forces, the military, has been involved in this response. The fire services have obviously been extensively involved in this. The fire chiefs have started to speak up over the past several months very publicly about the fact that, unlike the government, they believe that these fires are directly attributable to climate change. So far, the only response from right-wingers to try to dismiss this has been to blame everything on the Green Party. They have this absurd theory that, somehow the Green Party prevented controlled burn stuff from happening in the off seasons that would have reduced the amount of fuel available on the ground for these fires. Completely a fabrication. Not only have the Greens not been in power at the federal or state level, so they did not have a chance to enact policies like that, but also the fact that the fire seasons are getting longer, which means they start earlier in the season and they end later in the season, means that there is less and less time available to be able to actually do controlled management of the potential fuel on the ground. So you can't necessarily, climate change makes it harder to do any control measures anyway. So just to put that out there. The civilian government response has been essentially lacking, and more things have been turned over to direct military control or to direct control by the fire services. That is the situation that we have right now in Australia. Meanwhile, we have the opposition leader. There's a new leader because they just recently had elections where the opposition was expected to win and ended up doing disastrously and losing the election. They have a new leader. His policy policy, despite having this reputation earlier in his career as being someone who is more combative, his policy is all about consensus with the ruling party and not really being willing to criticize anything. There was a speculation on the Bunta Vista episode that the reason that he's unwilling to criticize the prime minister's trip to Hawaii, even in the most sort of bland terms and mild terms, is that he thinks that one day he will be prime minister and he will make a mistake similar to that, and he doesn't want to get hit on it for that, which I think is probably silly because he probably would get hit on it anyway, but that's a very sort of self-centered reason to just not make any sort of serious critique. We also had, as Rachel said, the high-ranking shadow minister from the opposition going around as these fires were burning, touting the need to burn more coal, to the need to export more coal. They are in lockstep with this government, even if they claim to believe the causes of climate change, which is a similar problem that we see in the United States, where the Democrats say, believe science. We believe that humans are causing climate change. Also, please buy our natural gas fracking infrastructure equipment. We have a situation here where the civilian leadership in both power and out of power is completely unwilling and incapable of acting on any of this situation. This is the liberal democracy leadership of this country, which, just, you know, to distinguish what we're talking about here, because this has been a theme of the Lend-Lease episodes of this show. When we're talking about liberal democracy, we're talking about the liberal, representative, multi-party, constitutional democracy that has an economic system of market liberalism or mild social democratic economics. But that is not, of course, the only kind of democracy. We've talked previously on the show about, you know, the anarcho-syndicalist model, where you have radical workplace democracy. Everyone in the entire country is electing their, you know, managers and leaders and bosses and so forth, and you work your way up through the entire system until you've every single position is being elected by the people. You also have the sort of, you know, democracy, you know, the Communist Party style democracy, where you have a vanguard party that says the problem with liberal democracy is that, you know, the business owner class and the plutocrats can completely buy elections and things like that. So they are counter-revolutionary, and we have to prevent them from participating in the democracy in order to protect actual democratic functions for the people. These are various alternative models that you can rate on a scale according to your own preferences of how democratic you think they are. But it's important to emphasize that when we're talking about alternatives to liberal democracy, we're not necessarily just talking about dictatorship. However, the situation that we are seeing in Australia shows the potential alternative if we do not move in a leftist direction as a response to climate change, if we do not move toward a equitable, just, socially enlightened leftist democracy and model of command economy to deal with the climate crisis. And the reason that I say that is that as the fire seasons get longer and the hurricane and flood seasons get longer and longer, we're going to see civilian governments, especially incompetent ones like in Australia, but also I think we're going to see this in other places, start handing more and more and more of their direct authority to the emergency responders and to the military to deal with this. I mentioned about the fire chiefs talking about the political aspects of climate change and so forth, talked about the military evacuations and their authority in this situation. And the broader question here, which you might think is being alarmist, but I'm about to show you why that's not alarmist, is that I am asking, at what point does civilian leadership in a crisis like this become either a failed state because they failed to respond to a crisis like this and just collapse, or they become a vestigial appendage to permanent emergency regimes? Because again, you could have a situation in a lot of these countries, especially countries that are affected by lethal level heat waves, where you have essentially a almost year-round state of emergency. There is no normal situation anymore. And to reiterate why I think this is not completely far-fetched, let's turn now to an article from the Australian Spectator. This was an opinion column, well, which they read at the beginning of episode 131 on Bunta Vista. Now, I did talk to Andrew and clarified, as I had suspected, that the author of this piece is not really necessarily being serious per se. He's a former employee and advisor to Tony Abbott, the former prime minister. He likes Tony Abbott a lot. He wrote this article basically just to boost up Tony Abbott and try to find Tony Abbott a new job. But I think that he has inadvertently, very concisely summed up what the right-wing response to climate emergencies will be. It doesn't even matter if they don't believe that climate change is happening. That is irrelevant to the question, because climate fascism or eco-fascism is a response to an ecological crisis like this that employs fascism. Here's the opening of that article in the Australian Spectator. Quote, effectively combating future natural disasters on the scale we're now witnessing, be they fire, flood, cyclone, or any other natural cause, needs a strong, powerful leader in ultimate charge who can cut through the crap, crush political, jurisdictional, and professional jealousies, and have overriding control of federal, state, and private resources for the common good of saving lives and property. A disaster supremo empowered by federal and state governments and ultimately accountable to them, able to put even prime ministers and state premiers in their place in times of dire emergency. Now, of course, the person he nominates for this is former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, volunteer firefighter. So again, this op-ed itself, not necessarily a serious proposal. It's more about Tony Abbott than this proposal for an emergency supremo or disaster supremo. But this, again, is inadvertently a very concise summation of where we are headed from the right-wing response on this. This is what you are facing in a crisis like this. You have two alternatives. One, you can go in a very centralized leftist direction to respond to these situations. Or two, you can have some sort of a military emergency regime or whatever you want to call it. But that is effectively what the choices are in a crisis like this. We are currently still below 1.5 degrees Celsius global temperature rise. That is the level that everyone is supposed to be striving for. Oh, we're going to limit the temperature rise to 1.5 because that is a limit that we think we can control some of the runaway effects, that we can climb back down from that before it gets to 2 degrees, or heaven forbid, 4 degrees. If it gets to 4 degrees, you know, by the end of the century, then human civilization is pretty much toast anyway. But 2 degrees, they're saying, okay, we're going to have, you know, significant social upheavals and collapses, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm saying, we are already at this point, and we haven't gotten to 1.5 yet. Even under the best case scenario, where we manage to hold the global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees, we are in for a chronic situation where massive national scale emergencies are affecting even the supposedly strongest, most stable liberal governments in the rich countries, not just the developing nations. This is the point that we are at already when we are less than 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise. And if you can see this happening now, you can see that since we are probably going to blow right through 1.5, by the time we get to 2 degrees, we are going to be seeing the conclusive end of liberal democracy. Now, again, as I have tried to emphasize on most of these episodes of Arsenal for Democracy Lend-Lease, my case here is not that, you know, okay, let's go full black pill and say everything is doomed and there's no hope, we're all going toward military dictatorships and failed states. I am saying that is one of the clear possibilities that is on the horizon, and the only other possibility capable of responding to the situation in a manner that does not just hand power to the military or a fascist regime with an emergency supremo, is to go in the leftist direction. Those are the alternative pathways that we have. Liberal democracy, market liberalism, this entire system is wholly incapable of responding to a crisis situation like this, and they have proven that to be the case. We are going to see these liberal representative democracy constitutional orders toppling left, right, and center. And again, what we have clearly shown why it is that the liberal democracies specifically are incapable of responding to this, it's because of the economic ideology that is baked in as well, and the fact that they allow participation in the system by the people whose economic interests are directly opposed to actually dealing with the emergency. And we saw this with the quotes about the coal exports. The coal industry, the coal export industry, is so powerful in Australia that they have captured both of the major parties, and during a period where a significant section of the country is on fire and we are seeing an Indiana-sized area of land being burned in one single fire season, we still have the two major parties in Australia under the liberal democratic system that they have arguing that the most important thing for Australia to do is to continue to export more coal. That is the case that Vanguard Party or other systems or strong social democracies make against having these people participate. The idea that you can have a democracy that is totally unrestricted in the way that liberal democracy does it is not viable to be able to actually solve the problems. Counterintuitively, you have to prevent the capital interests from participating in the democratic system in order to actually have genuine democracy and to be able to take the strong centralized measures necessary to combat an emergency situation like this without just handing complete control over to the military and the fire services, etc., indefinitely and possibly permanently. This is the only alternative to that situation. And I have been bringing this up in the awkward position that I am in, which is that I am an elected official now in a liberal democracy, and I know that it's a popular point of discourse on left Twitter to have discussions about electoralism and the values or non-values of participating in it. The case that I made recently on Twitter is I said, I think the thing about left electoralism within liberal democracies in this phase of the ecological crisis is that it can only ever be transitional anyway. So I'm not sure it's a problem as long as we're not putting all our eggs in that basket, speaking as an elected leftist. You shouldn't put your eggs in one strategic basket anyway, but the political, economic, and social realities of the unfolding climate crisis means that liberal democracy is coming to its conclusion within history. We hope for and must fight for other democratic forms to follow, or else the far right and capital formations will instead institute their own non-democratic economic and political regimes to react to the effects of the climate crisis. Either way, we're almost to the end of the line globally on our current phase of things. The period of now is transitional. I also would argue today that for the moment, it is still necessary and useful to contest within the electoral system because it is one of the few platforms in most of these countries that is given some amount of automatic legitimacy from the media or indeed the general public to be able to articulate a vision of a different future. Now, that's obviously a tricky balance because you can also have fringe candidates that get completely ignored as well. But by virtue of being a quote-unquote serious candidate or an elected official, even if you're a minor one like I am, you automatically get some ability to get your message out there to a wider audience. Moreover, I think that having a bench of candidates and elected officials likely serves as a nucleus of a new leftist-style democracy that succeeds liberal democracy. You could very dramatically say, oh, they're going to be the new founding fathers and mothers of, a post-liberal leftist democracy. Sure, whatever. But the other thing is that if things go in the opposite direction, you might want to have these people available as the core resistance leadership against a right-wing climate regime. I mean, they might also get taken out, right at the beginning. Oops. But I think it's important still and that there's utility to having this. The other thing that I would point out, though, and this is where it starts to get even more grim and potentially less optimistic, is that I would note that heat waves in Europe, the Middle East, and Brazil approaching or surpassing heat index levels outdoors that kill people automatically might signal the end of street protests as a potential response to this growing crisis. Historically, quote-unquote hot summers were often associated with various uprisings and riots around the world, but those summers were only hot enough to be merely annoying and make people mad or to cause famines, which certainly kill a lot of people, but not hot enough summers to actually kill people as they step out outdoors. What we've had going on, obviously, Rachel talked about the temperature in Australia being pretty unbearable and not being able to have people go outside partly because of the smoke. But also in Brazil, simultaneously, we're having a similar situation where we've had heat index days where people can't go outside in some of the major cities because they will die if they go outside. So that is a potential less optimistic case, basically, for a leftist future on this. But I think that what should be clear, and is clear to me anyway, despite how apocalyptic all of this sounds, is that the end of liberal democracy is coming almost with certainty in response to the climate situation. Now, Nate, if you wouldn't mind, going through some of the 20, 25, 30 countries very quick in quick succession here of whether they're the G20 countries in the powerful economic political bloc, or the top emitters of greenhouse gas, or just the most populous 20 or so countries. What is your assessment, or our assessment, of the likelihood of liberal democracy surviving in these countries in the face of mounting ecological collapse?
Yeah, quickly, before we get into that, I think it's worth talking about how various IPCC scientists, I think there's a story going around where I think someone asked them if they would, or if it would be possible to achieve their targets using market methods, or, you know, what you would expect in this type of system. And they just laughed at this person. And, you know, other people that are sort of associated with that, basically, they've admitted to me saying that, yeah, there's no way that we're going to be able to meet these targets. But I think they were operating under the assumption that we're just going to continue doing things as they are with maybe minor tweaks. So it's the people that are involved, they know. But as you were saying, Bill, there's too much stakeholders going on or having an influence to really make that difference. Like we're seeing now at Davos, everyone is freaking out about like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and how they're going to tax all these corporate, like they're thoroughly unequipped to deal with this, but they just know that they're sort of running out of time here, but that sort of accelerates all these tensions. Okay. So starting with the US, we've got, I mean, any listener to the show, I would think, knows what the situation is going on here. But just the notes that we have here talk about how Mitch McConnell basically just looked at the Constitution, said, oh, yeah, I can just bring this to a grinding halt so that nothing will get done. And basically accelerated a collapse of the U.S. system, which will be accelerated again by the climate emergency, tapping into chronic underlying social tensions. So I think that's pretty clear. And then we have UK breaking through the gridlock of first past post majorities for hard Brexit or right wing Tories now means that any pressure towards authoritarianism in crisis will be welcomed by the ruling party that wants to rule for a while. And of course, we saw the recent election with all the smears against Jeremy Corbyn and Labour not looking great there. Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about UK, the liberal democracy. That's like the liberal democracy, right? That's the Westminster system and everything. And you have a system where the even less corporate media than the United States absolutely willing to just crush and destroy the opposition, the leading opposition party, and prevent them from taking power, which again is the problem under the liberal form of democracy as opposed to democracies that prevent that sort of interference in the election.
Great country got there. Okay, Turkey, already a dictatorship facing climate pressure, so pretty clear there with Erdogan and all of his meddlings in Syria and everything involved with that, oppression of the Kurds. And then this is one, actually, we were looking at this list ahead of time, and we sort of, this one looks like a pretty bright spot in comparison to the rest. We've got South Korea, relatively young democracy, faces other problems too, of course, everything going on with tensions with North Korea. But as we were talking about, there is, you know, a long tradition of protest and social upheaval in response to the right-wing dictatorships for several decades in that country. And they recently show that they still sort of have that passion, came out and overthrew their sort of president who is conducting policy based on, what was it, like tarot readings and like astrology.
Corrupt, yeah.
extremely. So there was a lot of weird stuff. And so, but that sort of showed that they're still, they're much more active than, say, the United States, or in terms of protest culture and things like that. So that's like, I would say that's a relatively bright spot in comparison to some of these other ones. But there's probably lots of different climate pressures too. And there's like laws where you can't be a communist and stuff. So I think there's issues there too. So let's see. South Africa, a relatively young one-party democracy under immense pressure to deal with water crises and unresolved racial apartheid. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts on this are.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing there is just that South Africa has, as we said, a one-party democracy that's on relatively shaky footing as it is. Obviously, rampant corruption is a problem there. And they have major, major cities that just do not have enough water for people to drink. So Good luck.
Saudi Arabia. Not exactly a liberal democracy, although the sales job put forward by Mohammed bin Salman and aided and abetted by New York Times and other
McKinsey,
basically would have us be convinced that he's a great guy who just, you know, occasionally happens to sometimes cut up some of his critics with a bone saw. Totally normal. They are facing huge coming water crises that'll probably exacerbate tensions and possibly repression of Shia in Saudi Arabia, and yeah, not, and possibly they're meddling all around the region. So then we have come to Russia, already a de facto dictatorship, but should be noted faced 2010 drought in the bread bowl of Russia that also triggered the Arab Spring. And so we're seeing the connection between these various climate crises and effective economic pressures that can lead to social upheaval, revolution. And that was also a trigger of the war in Syria, which is, of course, also connected to the Arab Spring. So then, of course, Russia also is, in general, quite a poor country, especially now. And the actual GDP of Russia doesn't really match up with the hysterical portrayal of Russia that we're given in U.S. media. They, like, have one aircraft carrier, so not even really. I think it's falling apart. Okay, then Mexico, young democracy facing constant internal security threats and future water crises. Yeah, what with various cartel warfare going on and all sorts of water shortages, I think that sort of spells trouble in the future. Japan, quasi-fascist ruling party with no significant opposition. Recent polls show single-digit support for the opposition parties. And Bill, earlier you mentioned that the highest polling is no party.
Yes, but something like 41% of the country saying that they would prefer none of the parties to be ruling. But that's not an option. So guess who's going to continue being the ruling party?
Then we get to Italy. Quintessentially unstable democracy with mounting fascist pressure. That's right. The classic joke about Italy, what, they have 60 governments, 60 years. And then, of course, there are still people that proudly call themselves fascist for all this time.
I think Lega Nord is like now the largest party or something.
So they've been biding their time waiting to try to get more into power.
They tried to just do a constitutional reform, but the courts said no to that. So that's
then, what is it? Alexandra Mussolini is, isn't she an MP or in the European Parliament or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay, so moving on from there. Well, of course, Italy is also the birthplace of fascism. Indonesia, young democracy on the front lines of climate effects, return to military rule seems very plausible in a crisis. Yeah. Basically, Indonesia was a military dictatorship for much of its...
I think until like 99 or something like that. Like it was in the
90s. Yeah, well, officially, but there's still a pretty significant military influence in government, I would say. So, yeah, that could definitely swing back into power. It's sort of as they did on the transition from Sukarno to Suharto, where they just sort of took power and eliminated all opposition with the genocide. So, great. Then we come to India. Quasi-fascist ruling party is dismantling democracy ahead of likely near permanent climate crisis. And this has reached, sort of peak tensions recently. I even saw a protest here in the United States in support of Modi and the citizenship law.
We're going to talk more on a future episode that's coming up about that. But yeah, just the brief sort of summary there is you've got a basically fascist party democratically elected to power all over the country. This is the largest democracy in the world, and they're going to be facing, you know, they are already facing, similar to South Africa, the water, drinking water crises for major cities. We're talking millions and millions of people not being able to get drinking water. And then we are talking about heat wave problems where people are going to get killed going outside. So,
yeah. And then, of course, also sea level rise in places like Bangladesh, or that would also affect parts of India as well. So,
right.
Yeah. Okay. So Germany, that's next. And you put under here, Bill, probably eventually the far right coming to power. We've seen an increase in, unfortunately, a group that shares the initials of this podcast, Alternative for Deutschland. But then there's also other even more hard right Nazi parties and organizations.
Yeah, I mean, like you said with South Korea, probably if there is a bright spot on the list, somehow it's Germany, but only because of like norms and things like that are in place to try to prevent that. But like, also this seething undercurrent is like, yeah, if things actually really hit the fan, it seems pretty imaginable.
I saw this going on when I was in Germany a couple of years ago, and yeah, there were skinhead rallies and anti-Muslim protests, things like that. So definitely, I'd start getting a little bit worried, because you don't want to see what happens when Germany goes far right. But I think the fact that there is a center right party, the Christian Democrats, that have at least some influence, that's sort of a barrier. And also, there's been, I think, recent strengthening of the Die Linke left wing party and the Greens as well. So it's not all bad, but
as we saw in Austria, the Greens are willing to work with right wingers because they're
always
not.
Always got to be careful about the Greens, because sometimes they can be quite neoliberal, and other times I think their Green parties have sort of pushed almost neo-fascist, climate fascist talking points type of thing. So definitely something to worry about. So then, of course, another potential bright spot, but we'll talk about this, France. We've got an extremely autocratic liberal constitution with an autocratically minded, democratically elected president, happy to use emergency powers while governing a volatile population with powerful fascist opposition parties. Famous heat waves plus terrorism plus domestic unrest equals end of liberalism. And we've seen the Yellow Vest movement going on, lots of protests in France that have been ongoing, lots of strikes, various opposition to Macron. He's pretty unpopular at this point, but of course, he was elected so Marine Le Pen would not get in. He's quite unpopular. And then the question is, will Front National ever get elected? And they've come awfully close now. So
yeah. And again, to underline this, of all of these liberal democracies, with the possible exception of the United States, and even then, I would say that it goes farther than the United States Constitution, the French Constitution has one of the most powerful unitary presidencies, all the power being vested in one person is very that's sort of the hallmark of France. Yes. And the fact that he personally describing himself as the Jupiterian Sun King and stuff like that, he has the mindset to use this, as does his chief opponent, Le Pen. He can potentially use this in its fully dictatorial powers. And we have already seen him and his predecessor use pretty extensive permanent emergency powers in response to terrorist incidents. So the idea that French liberal democracy is going to survive a climate crisis is ludicrous to me. I don't see that happening.
Although in that situation, you might have a little more faith that the French would try to come up with something different and, set up, Paris Commune type of things.
Right.
Or whatever,
I mean, that's the only thing.
They have a long history of the population riot in the streets.
The population might riot in the streets. But again, whatever they set up is also not going to be a liberal democracy. Right. Like if they overthrow a Macron government or a Le Pen government, they're not going to set up liberal democracy either. So that's the end of it.
All right. Then we talk about European Union has failed to enforce any kind of punishments on the liberal right wing governments within their own borders. That's absolutely true, especially when you think about Hungary or things like that. So continuing on, China, already a command economy. And then you can debate into whether, is China socialist, blah, blah, blah. But they are investing in various green technologies, but also there's still emitting a lot. So, and then the question is, what would the Communist Party then sort of try to increase their control? Because in a lot of places, at least in the past, they've sort of had somewhat tenuous control over certain parts of the country, or just there was simmering unrest in places. And you sort of wonder what would happen then. Would they try to clamp down harder, or what would be the effect? But there's already a lot of climate-related issues in China, whether it's air quality and things like that. So then we've got Canada, ruling Liberal Party, obsessed with expanding fossil fuels, kind of irrelevant who's actually in charge. The whole shale oil situation has really been a debacle in terms of actually trying to decarbonize, but they have a lot of money coming up from those tar pits. So.
Yeah, I think within this list, Canada is probably one of the likelier ones to maintain a sort of facade of liberal democracy in the face of various crises. But as they alluded to on the Bunta Vista podcast, a lot of the help that Australia typically gets comes from when it's fire season, comes from firefighters in North America, specifically the United States and Canada. And this has been harder and harder to do as the fire seasons have gotten longer in all three of these places, because they can't do reciprocal arrangements if they have overlapping or nearly overlapping fire seasons. It's more of a problem probably in the United States first, but eventually it's going to be a challenge for Canada. Canada, just by virtue of its location, is probably able to weather some of the crises longer than others. They're going to have various deleterious impacts from climate change, especially in the polar regions, but not necessarily in the way that it's going to impact a lot of these other countries on this list.
Great. So they're going to continue to feel superior to us without any reason why. Great.
Yep. Cool.
And then, of course, there's the whole stuff with Trudeau, like actually approving pipelines and stuff that he said he was going to not do, and touting energy export. But yeah, we covered that. Okay, Brazil. Oh, my God. Bolsonaro, fascist government, literally willing to burn the earth.
That's about all we need to say on that.
Yep. And then we talked about Australia, incompetent and irremovable right-wing government facing an opposition that is unwilling to criticize their handling of crisis and agrees with the government on coal exports. They will vote away their own democracy during a climate emergency sooner or later. I mean, kind of hard to deny that when you see some of the pictures that's basically like from a science fiction film of people like huddled on the beach under the blood red sky. And then we have Argentina. Bill's notes: does anyone think this is a generally durable liberal democracy?
Another one that's probably going to hold out for a little bit longer than some of the other ones, but also relatively recent transition out of military dictatorship, and there have been some things that have happened in the past, you know, 20, 30 years that would lead you to suspect that they're probably not super durable. Other countries outside of the G20 group itself that are sort of major countries that we should think about here.
As you mentioned, in places like Bangladesh and Nigeria, on the front lines of climate change, basically that's where democracies will be the first to fall into climate crisis, as you know, what happens when large parts of the country just gets flooded or there's massive refugee evacuations, things like that. So there's a bunch of other countries where the grasp of liberal democracy is tenuous at best, including Ukraine, Thailand, Poland, and Pakistan. So
Iran also on the list. They're not a liberal democracy, already facing water problems, so similar to the Saudi Arabia problem.
And then sort of the list rounds out with Duterte's Philippines. We've got Egypt, Vietnam, Democratic Republic of Congo,
Ethiopia, and then, as well.
Yeah, those are sort of the next coming up, but I think we're in a situation where it just they're pretty clearly have no idea what to do with it, and just sort of we're sort of hoping that Elon Musk fixes it or something. That's sort of what people are still like leaning on, it seems like,
which is crazy.
Like agitating for their pet issue, like, oh, if only we do nuclear, or everything will be fine.
Or we need to do such and such other technology, you know, hydrogen fuel cells, or we need to do nuclear fusion.
Carbon capture.
Yeah, whatever it is, there's something. Anyway, my point in summarizing all of these countries is just to basically say, sure, I could be wrong. Maybe liberal democracy is going to weather all of this, but I've presented a whole bunch of evidence that suggests that we're already seeing it's not capable of it in even the rich and stable liberal democracies like Australia. And I've now presented with Nate this list of my analysis of the 30 basically most powerful or populous countries in the world and the various crises they're facing, and made the case that almost all of them, if they still have a liberal democracy right now, that it's not going to survive, and a lot of them already do not. And my point in all of this is, you may think it's crazy for me to say, like, oh, what a fringe opinion to say that liberal democracy is on the way out and that it's the end of the liberal world as we know it. And my counterargument is, prove that I'm wrong. Why is the preponderance of evidence in favor of it actually enduring? I mean, as far as I can tell, the argument just boils down to like not being able to imagine that it couldn't, or, oh, it's more able to weather these storms than you think it is. And I'd say, really? Are you sure about that? Does history actually back you up on that in a lot of various crises? Is that actually the case where they're completely under siege? I mean, again, even countries like the United Kingdom often had a tendency to just like suspend elections during, you know, like World War One or whatever. Like, they just, so what is the case here that they're going to, that these countries are actually going to weather these storms? Again, there's a number of different pathways that could happen. One, you could go in the leftist direction, which is not a liberal democracy. We're arguing that that's a positive direction to go in. It's a different kind of democracy, but it's not a liberal democracy. So that would end liberal democracy. Or you have situations where you have just a failed state. The country just completely collapses in on itself because of an inability to respond to a particularly significant crisis, like a water crisis or something like that. Okay, that's the end of liberal democracy in a country like that. Or you just very slowly or in a particularly significant crisis hand over all of your emergency powers from the civilian government to military leadership and emergency responders as your answer to a particularly thorny crisis that you are incapable of dealing with. That would also end liberal democracy. Again, you may preserve the trappings of liberal democracy in some of those, but in real terms, that would be the end of it. Rachel, I will turn it over to you to give summary thoughts on all of this, and then we will wrap up our episode.
I just kind of wanted to circle back to Germany. I went there last year at the end, September and October. I think to kind of add to what Nate was saying, I think that it's kind of encouraging. There were climate changes happening, or climate change marches happening on Fridays, kind of going along with Greta Thunberg. It looked like those were a big draw in the major German cities. So I'm hoping that it's kind of a brighter spot than what Nate was saying. I think the left is trying to get their act together in Germany. So perhaps there is kind of an eco-socialist future there to be had, hopefully.
I just have no faith in the SPD at this point. Just none whatsoever. Yeah.
There was a lot of graffiti that was anti-AFD. So kind of the sentiment on the streets was very anti-right-wing. If you're going by graffiti as kind of a marker of public sentiment.
A real land of contrasts.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting to see. There's a lot of ACAB graffiti happening as well. So I think there's kind of an anti-authoritarian, checking the barometer of Germany, kind of anti-authoritarian, anti-right-wing. So hopefully there will be a leftist coalition forming there. Kind of going off of like the Canada thing too, I think we can't really rely on pretty attractive authority figures to save us. It just isn't going to work. Trudeau has been talking out of both sides of his mouth for a long time with regards to energy. So I think there needs to be a truly international leftist coalition to kind of head off eco-fascism and hold it at bay. We're looking at a very stark fork in the road at this point, and the only paths forward are eco-socialism or eco-fascism. So we on the left really need to take a good hard look at our future and choose eco-socialism, because the only alternative is eco-fascism.
All right, well, that's it for episode 20 of Arsenal for Democracy Lend Lease. Nate, thank you for being on this week.
Thanks, guys.
And Rachel, thank you for being on as well.
Thanks for having me.